You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Ageism and sexism are the founding materials of a glass ceiling women have spent decades dismantling, a foundation that doesn't discriminate on industry. CAP Radio's new podcast, A Music of Their Own, shares the stories of women of all ages who've carved out success in classical music despite the odds and opportunities being stacked against them. An industry where just a sliver of music programmed by American orchestras were written by women in the last year alone. But there aren't just plenty of personal experiences to illustrate these barriers, also science. Indre Viscontis is both a neuroscientist and an opera performer with an accomplished career in both science and music. But like many women with successful careers, that success also includes obstacles based on her age or just simply identifying as a woman. Indre joins us along with Majel Connery, the host of A Music of Their Own. Good morning to you both. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Indre, you have quite a career as a neuroscientist and an opera performer. I can now check that box. I have met someone who is both involved in opera and neuroscience. How did this come about? And did both passions come at the same time or did one precede the other?
Well, I will say that certainly opera preceded neuroscience, because when I was 11, I did not know what neuroscience
exactly
was.
Yeah, good point.
But that's when I made my debut at the Canadian Opera Company as an altar boy in Tosca. And, you know, that experience being on the stage with all of those musicians and the director and, you know, the theatricality of it. And then at the end of the night being handed a check for hundreds of dollars for an 11-year-old, it was like, yeah, I want to do this. But later on, I learned about the practicalities of how challenging it is to make a career in music. And I also discovered the writings of Oliver Sacks, and I got really interested in the brain. And so I sort of pivoted and started to look into psychology and neuroscience, but at the same time, continued to train my voice and, you know, tried to keep up my training that way.
And you are continuing to do a remarkable job of, it's not as if like neuroscience is in one room and music is in another. You weave both together. Where did you begin doing that? How did that evolve and take shape?
Yeah, so for a long time, I didn't, because I didn't want to be considered a dilettante in either domain. But it was after I finished my PhD that I decided, you know what, if I spent this same kind of energy, like devoted everything I had to music, how much more ahead would I be? How much better as a singer? You know, how much could I really learn? And so I went back and did a master's of music and voice performance after my PhD. And that's really, I think, where things changed for me, because I started to see that there are ways in which I could use the neuroscience of learning and memory in particular to help musicians develop more effective practice strategies, to help them mitigate performance anxiety, and essentially speak, you know, science to them that they're very much hungry to hear, but that they just didn't have access to. And that was really a role I could play.
You authored a book titled How Music Can Make You Better, and you focus on how music affects the brain. So why do we have this urge to hear certain music when we're feeling an array of emotions, whether we're sad, excited, or in love, etc.?
Well, so there's a lot of ways in which we can think about this question. And I think that, you know, one of the metaphors that I use is that music is like a Swiss Army knife, and you have a specific tool for a specific purpose. And you develop that tool or that toolkit over the course of your lifetime. So there are periods in your life where music plays a really important role. Like one period, for example, is, you know, during puberty, early adolescence, and young adulthood, when you're trying to figure out who you are, and music is a really powerful way of helping you do that. So that means that you then have this nostalgia and this sense of identity tied into this music you love. And you might want to listen to it when you're feeling a bit adrift, when you're feeling not quite yourself. But you might want to listen to a completely different set of musical, you know, tools when you're feeling something else. And so, you know, music really hits at your emotional memories, but also, you know, helps mitigate your current emotional states, et cetera. So there's a lot of different ways in which we use it. And I think sometimes the mistake that people make is thinking of it as a sledgehammer and this trying to use the wrong tool for the wrong purpose.
I love those metaphors and analogies from a Swiss Army knife to a sledgehammer. You make it so visual. Given that you're both in neuroscience as well as in opera and in music, I mean, both of these fields, I would imagine, are dominated by men. What challenges did you initially face in both of your careers?
You know, I found that in neuroscience, I feel like there was more of an openness to women giving intellectual contributions. So it wasn't until relatively late into my PhD that I started to see discrimination on the part of my gender. Up until then, I actually felt like my gender provided me with opportunities. There were scholarships specifically for women in science. And it seemed like most people listened when I talked. But as you kind of go up the ladder, as you go into these rooms where they're more dominated by men, you know, there's this implicit bias that sometimes seeps in. Again, not every person, and actually not, it's not limited to men. There are plenty of, you know, female identifying individuals who also fall victim to this implicit bias. But there's a sense that people just don't listen as carefully often to women in these roles. And I've often now had the experience of someone coming up to me afterwards, after a meeting or a group call, and saying, "Wow, I really noticed that you said idea X." And then when it was repeated virtually verbatim by a man in the room, everybody listened, and then everybody took that idea on. And this has happened to me in neuroscience conversations, but also as an opera stage director, which is something I pivoted to a few years ago. And it's kind of shocking. But in you know, it's like you feel when you experience it, you kind of think, okay, well, maybe it's just in my head. You know, maybe I just wasn't clear enough. But when someone else tells you that they noticed it, that's when you start to see, okay, maybe this is a more of a systemic issue.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking about it in terms of journalism as well as a woman in journalism. I mean, I've had people talk to me, trying to tell me a really good story that was done, and I was the one who did the story. And then they would proceed to continue to explain the story to me as if I didn't do it myself. So when it comes to your musical pursuits and your pursuit of opera, a performer turned director, how does these two experiences compare? You shared some with neuroscience, and if you can expand upon your experiences while working in opera.
So in opera, there is all an overt ageism in the sense that, you know, there are roles that are geared towards younger appearing women, right? So like there is a kind of ceiling. So right from the outset, you are told that, like, for example, for young artists programs, you know, there is a cap for how old a woman can be in order to audition for a particular program. And often that cap is actually lower for women than for men. And, you know, that's its own conversation. But so there's already this built-in thing that, like, okay, if you're reaching your early 30s and you haven't been successful in landing one of these young artist programs, time is really ticking and you don't really have the opportunity for a career. So that's already built in. That's problematic for a number of reasons, but not the least of which is that when you're actually casting for a show, sometimes it's the older singers that are much sort of more suited to the acting requirements of the roles because they have more experience. But that is often, you know, considered not as important as sort of like the fact that they're young and have all this potential and et cetera. So that's on the sort of singing side. When it comes to the directing side, I feel like there is just this sense that, you know, as a director, you have to have a vision and you have to be clear on that vision. But there's, of course, a lot of subjectivity built in. And so it's easy for someone's implicit biases to dismiss the vision of a director on the basis of some of these, you know, external factors. And actually, Majel and I think have both experienced this, where, you know, you get reviewed and the notes from the, you know, reviewer are all about how great the acting was on stage, but, you know, that somehow the direction fell short. And, you know, in my mind, that's just kind of mind-boggling. I've wanted to actually do a study to see if that happens more often to female directors. It might not. And, you know, this might just be my experience. But my sense is that, look, the director, in my opinion, their primary job is to tell the story through the acting and enable the singers to do their best acting-wise. And if you achieve that, you can't then say that the direction was bad. And you know, so that's kind of, you know, where I see that there are these ways in which then these reputations get made. And, you know, the fact that you might get dismissed as a female director because, you know, your vision is not considered bold enough, which is often not true, you know, can really hurt you.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Indre Viscontis, a neuroscientist and opera singer, also director, about the connection between science, music, and the role gender plays in the music landscape. Okay, Majel, you know, she touched upon something that I think we all, I mean, we're three women talking about in our respective industries and about ageism and sexism, but at the end of the day, we're all going to get older, right? So how do we overcome, or particularly in the field of music and classical music, how do you overcome, you know, getting older while still being successful and making strides in an industry that is overwhelmingly male?
I think there are a few rare examples of women who have managed somehow to eschew sex and sex appeal entirely in the course of their career. One of the women that we talk about on A Music of Their Own is Patti Smith, who has an incredible following and is not a young woman anymore. But because her appeal has never been premised on sex, she doesn't need it now to continue to be popular. And in the field of opera, I actually think there's a few women like Renee Fleming, maybe, if you agree with me, Indre, who have also managed somehow to just put this sex appeal item into a closet and to forgo it entirely. Now, I don't know Renee Fleming personally, but she does seem to be a woman who is flourishing now in the late stages of her career. So I think it's possible, but I think you have to start early, which is to say, if you rely entirely on high heels, fishnets, and big smiles early in your career, you cannot then pivot when it becomes problematic in your mid-40s and start doing something else. You have to start early on asserting yourself as an artist, as an opera singer, as a composer, whatever it is, and be very mindful of how you are relying on your body or your ability to have a drink with some guy after the show.
Yeah, that it's shouldering a lot, definitely early in your career, is just trying to figure out where you want to go in life and with your passions. Indre, do you agree with that?
I do. And I just want to say, you know, Renee Fleming is incredibly beautiful. And I still think has, you know, definitely has that sex appeal. And I think that that's something that we sort of assume is not the case later on in life. But she's also become this exceptional advocate for music and the mind and showed just how whip smart she is. And that brings me to the point that oftentimes to have longevity as a woman in these fields, you can't be mediocre. You have to be so exceptional that people can't help but agree that, yes, you know, you still deserve to be on stage. And I think, you know, I often sort of have gone to, you know, these kinds of speaker events, and I've been on stage with predominantly men. And I will say that not all the men are exceptional. And I know plenty of women who, you know, also would belong on that stage, but there seems to be a higher bar for women, especially over the age of 40, than there is for men.
When it comes to actually listening to music, and Majel touches upon this on the podcast, A Music of Their Own, are there actually, you know, feminine and masculine expressions in music or characteristics that are inherently considered feminine and considered masculine, Indre?
So, I mean, there are definitely, you know, look, I think of gender as a mosaic as opposed to binary. So if you were in Las Vegas and you were gambling on whether a person who knits is going to identify as female or male, you're going to vote, you know, you're probably going to put your chips on the female. But that doesn't mean you aren't going to miss some of the others. And the same thing is true in the brain. There are certain, you know, aspects of the brain that are more likely to skew one way or another, depending on a person's gender identity. But I think that, you know, when we're talking about people who are successful in these fields, like, we are talking about the exceptions. And so you really, at that point, and the outliers of these curves, you know, you then can't say, oh, yes, there's a definitely a higher likelihood of X or Y feature depending on gender.
Are we just putting our subconscious or our personal experiences into this listening experience? Or can the brain really hear the difference between a male or a female composer?
That, I mean, I would argue no, because oftentimes the brain now can't tell the difference between a human and an AI generated composer.
Good point. Yeah.
So I don't know how the gender would fit into that. Do I think there is something that the female voice as a group could add that is missing from sort of male-dominated composition? Yeah, I do think so. And I think that's true also in terms of direction, in terms of neuroscience. I mean, there are definitely diversity is something that is incredibly powerful when it comes to creativity. You know, if I use the edge effect as an example of this. This is where two ecosystems meet, like, you know, the forest meeting a river, et cetera. And this is where there is a huge amount of biodiversity. That's where there's the most sort of number of species that can thrive there. And I think that's true in all of these industries. You know, diversity is something that leads to more creativity and better outcomes.
Majel, you know, you are an accomplished musician and artist yourself. You're also in academia. What have you learned by having these conversations that marry your own personal experiences in the music industry?
I have to say that I view the current moment we are in as having a greater complexity than I appreciated. I view sexism in a way as a tool that I can use if I choose to forward opportunities or take advantage of things that men might not have. But during the surge in Me Too recently and all the Harvey Weinstein stuff, I am forced to acknowledge that there is a real double edge here. Like when you read that the women who were assaulted by Harvey Weinstein continued to stay in touch with him, I recognize my own urges in that decision, which on the surface seems very poor. Why don't you just grab your purse, walk out of the room, and never talk to the guy again? Well, the reason is because you don't always have opportunities like that in your career. And if you really want to get ahead, if you walk out of the room with Harvey Weinstein, there's just going to be another Harvey Weinstein behind the next door. So like, you have to pick your battles, but it's really not as simple as is represented. You can't just choose to have certain interactions and not to have other interactions and just find the really good people out there. It's just not that black and white. And a lot of the women on the podcast tell very, very complicated and personal stories of having to make choices that do not always work in their favor, even when on the surface, those choices seem to be the correct moral, ethical, and upstanding ways to behave as a woman in the world.
Well, because they're working in a field that at the onset wasn't set up to be fair, and you have people in positions of power that are not really reflective of the diversity of this community, whether it's, you know, race, ethnicity, as well as gender. Andre, why do you think having these conversations are so important?
Well, for one thing, you know, even though I've talked about implicit bias and this idea that, you know, there are parts of our brains that we just aren't available to us consciously, and we make a lot of decisions from those places, and afterwards we can justify those decisions, but that might not be the reason that we went in that direction to begin with, implies that we have no control. But the truth is that even implicit biases can be moved around and shifted. So one example I like to give is that, you know, if you show people a person, say like a woman in a leadership position, before you ask them a bunch of questions that would reveal an implicit bias, you can shift around how that person answers those questions, even though it's outside of their conscious awareness. So having these conversations, recognizing the behaviors that are a result of implicit bias, and then attempting to create conditions in which those behaviors are not rewarded or they're not successful, this is really what we need to be doing. And if we don't talk about it, frankly, I think people think that, oh, but look, there's all these, you know, now awards and scholarships and grants for, you know, women composers and women directors, et cetera. And so like, problem solved. But that's not enough, because you need to then see whether those women are put into situations in which they can thrive and in which their work speaks for itself, rather than, you know, people then just saying, well, she got there because, you know, they had this special grant.
Andre, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andre Viscontes is both a neuroscientist and an opera performer turned director. Majel, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, Vicky. Thank you.
Majel Connery is the host of A Music of Their Own, discussing the experiences and science behind ageism and sexism in the music industry. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.